Our topic this evening is a kiss, and our speaker is Brother Jeff.
Good evening. I'm glad Clyde started or spoke about redemption, because it's something that we don't find in Judas, and you probably guessed by now that the subject has to do with the betrayal, Judas's betrayal of Jesus. And I think we might actually come back to this 2 Corinthians 13 reading at the end. Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Thanks for bringing that out, Clyde. But let's go to Matthew chapter 26, our reading for tonight. Now, I had just a couple of sections read, mostly just for convenience to kind of set our minds around the events that are happening here. And actually, I think this is a bit of a different style for me, this what I've got for you tonight. It seems to be a bit more information than and perhaps even a little supposition than I normally have. However, the verses 47 to 49 are really what I had in mind when I picked this subject, where Judas betrays Jesus with a kiss. And the obvious question to me was, why did Judas use a kiss to betray Jesus? Why was this a sign? Why did he pick this? And is it important to us? Does it really matter? And something that we should really note is that a kiss was a common way for Jewish men to greet each other, apparently. And so this kind of a greeting was not uncommon among the Jews at the time. So it would have seemed that he was just simply walking up to Jesus and greeting him normally. So was it really done in order to point Jesus out? Was this kiss supposed to be a sign so that the people that Judas had with him to arrest Christ would understand who he was? Wouldn't they have already known? Wouldn't they have already known who Jesus was? Perhaps not, perhaps. Verse 48, however, does seem to indicate that this was the reason, because it says, "Whoever I shall kiss, that is he. Hold him fast." In fact, if we go to the Mark record in verse 44 of chapter 14, it tells us there, and you might want to, while we're going through these things, keep your finger in the passages and just glance at the parallel records. I'm not going to go through every verse in all the parallel records, but just keep that in mind to glance at the context. But chapter 14 of Mark, verse 44 says, "And he that betrayed him had given them a token, saying, Whomever I shall kiss, that same is he. Take him and lead him away safely." Now, interesting aside here is that he says, "Take him away safely." Judas apparently wanted Jesus led away safely. Now, is this significant? Maybe. It contradicts perhaps the idea of him wanting to start an uprising by provoking Jesus when he says to them, "Well, I want him led away safely," but we'll touch on this idea a bit later. But the point is here that he's pointing Jesus out with this kiss as a sign. So if Judas really needed to point out who Jesus was, why did he have to do it this way? Why not simply hide behind the bush with all the guys about to ambush Jesus and say, "Oh yeah, that guy right there, he's him, the one in the purple robes or the blue robes, or colors aren't right, but why didn't he do it that way? Well, in John 18, we see a bit of a different story. Let's just flip over to John 18. There's no mention in the John record of the sign, of the kiss that Judas greeted Jesus with. But there is mention of Jesus coming forward. And not only once, but twice. We read, coming in at verse, well, let's go right to verse 4, or verse 2 rather. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials and the chief priests and Pharisees, or some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. And Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. And when Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. And again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he goes on to say, "I told you I am he." Now, this is interesting because Jesus comes forward, apparently knowing where the soldiers are. And now we're kind of looking at how these events logically fit together. And says, "Who are you looking for?" Now, where does Judas's greeting fit in here? Does it fit in before or after Jesus makes this move? Not only that, but they actually fall to the ground, and I guess I hadn't caught on this point before, but they actually drew back and fell to the ground, according to verse 6. So it seems like they're not such a menacing group after all. They have a bit of fear for Christ, unless I'm reading the language wrong. So how does this fit with the other records? When does Judas actually kiss Jesus? And the logical sequence that I came up with would be that Judas would greet Jesus first, then the soldiers would begin to come forward. Jesus, knowing they were coming, would go out to meet them and ask who they were looking for, and then the sequence follows. The NIV Study Bible suggests something a bit different. It suggests that Jesus identified himself first, and then Judas followed through with his greeting. Well, this would suggest one of perhaps three things. First, that there was maybe some paranoia on Judas's part that the officers wouldn't believe Jesus, or hadn't believed Jesus, when he said, "I am he." However, by their reaction, it seems that they did. So I'm not sure about that. The second point is, well, perhaps Judas was a bit of a stickler for sticking to the plan. There was nothing was going to drive him away from the plan. The plan was, we'd arrange this sign, and I'm going to follow through on it. Or thirdly, maybe he had such strong feelings against Jesus at this point that he simply wanted to rub it in. Another possibility, going back to the question of why Judas would arrange this signal in the first place, is that it was the best kind of signal to arrange, because from Judas's and the leader's point of view, they want to minimize the alarm and try to get their group of soldiers around Christ to contain him before he is alarmed. They don't want to alert him prematurely. They want to surprise him. They want to ambush him. So the least likely way to do this is, the least likely way to alarm him was to have someone he knew come and greet him. So perhaps this was in the plan all along, that Judas would go up, greet him, signal who he was. Maybe it was dark by this time, and Judas would in fact walk up, slow the whole group down to a stop, greet Jesus, and then they would have opportunity to move in and arrest him. Why take so much caution? Well, they had to assume that there was a possibility for violence, that Jesus might defend himself at this point. In fact, the disciples believed that Jesus would at some point establish the kingdom. The disciples believed that, and I think Judas would have too. That Jesus would, by force, perhaps, resist. So the leaders and arresting soldiers probably hid themselves planning this ambush and this signal in this way. His actions would hopefully put them off guard, put them at ease, and indicate who Jesus was so that they could target him specifically. Seems plausible. Seems plausible to me. Now, the idea of being off guard isn't a foreign one. Judas's greeting may have been particularly for that purpose. In fact, if we go to 2 Samuel 20, you'll probably remember this is the occasion where Joab kills Amasa. And he comes to him in the guise of friendship. Joab greets Amasa in 2 Samuel 20 and verse 9, saying, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him, a greeting. But Amasa did not observe that the sword that was in Joab's hand, so Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails on the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, son of Bichri. Joab was looking to catch Amasa off guard. How do you catch someone off guard? Well, he pretended to be his friend. So is this what Judas had been all about all along? Was Judas pretending all along? Did he have any inclination as to be a disciple of Jesus? Perhaps. Also related to this incident is Psalm 55. Verse 21 particularly has some familiar rings in it. In Psalm 55, verse 21, it says, "The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords." And this seems to ring quite true of Judas. I keep forgetting his name for some reason. Judas. His words were "Rabbi, greetings, Rabbi, greetings, Master," and a kiss of a friend. He plays the friend, and yet literally there are drawn swords, and his friendship is literally a sword for Jesus and his followers at the time. The very act of greeting Jesus, in fact, would condemn them in his mind. War was in his heart. Was this his motivation? Verse 21 also mentions, "But war was in his heart." Was this Judas's motivation? Was he perhaps even a rebel against Rome, looking for an opportunity to start an uprising? And maybe this group of disciples was one of those opportunities, he thought. So we come to this question of motivation, all the discussion of the logical sequence of events, and hows and whys, and why did Judas use a kiss? And it all comes back to this question of motivation. What is it that motivated Judas? What was his drive? What was the driving force? Now, some have suggested that Judas was a member of an anti-Roman freedom-fighting group. And he had hoped that Jesus would, in fact, lead a rebellion and perhaps influence the rest of the disciples to think along the same lines, I don't know. And hope that the arrest would, in fact, incite rebellion and maybe even spark an uprising against Rome. And hope to force Jesus, perhaps, into taking action against Rome. Well, this was what the disciples had hoped for, too. They had hoped that Jesus would free Israel from Roman rule. And so, surely forced, Judas might think, Jesus would defend his very life. With his life in the balance, with his life on the line, surely he would break out in force against the Roman authorities. I would think he would need some kind of significant motivation. He would have had to be a pretty dedicated rebel to have lived with Jesus all this time, to have listened to everything that Jesus had to teach, to have spent so much time with his fellow disciples and yet turn around and betray Jesus. So it again begs the question, why did Judas want to betray Jesus in the first place? Is 30 pieces of silver really enough of a temptation for a betrayal? And I had understood that 30 pieces of silver was a rather small amount, enough to buy a common slave. Judas would have certainly expected more than a small amount from the leaders. Perhaps he was looking for power and riches beyond this time, but I think there was more to this 30 pieces of silver than a measly amount of pocket change. Perhaps. So, sorry. Just drop down. So this 30 pieces of silver then, was it really a pittance? And I think we can go to Bible context first and find that it wasn't. Exodus 31:32 records the worth of a slave. And interesting, as a slight aside, in light of Christ's behavior in John 13, he put himself forward as a servant to the disciples in John 13 when he washed the disciples' feet. And here we find in Exodus 31:32 that this is the value attributed to a slave, 30 shekels of silver. And the verse reads, "If the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned." So there's one piece of evidence for a bit more value to this 30 shekels of silver. Again, Matthew 26, going back to Matthew, I think the context in Matthew actually helps us to see this, highlights this even more. And we go to verse 14 of Matthew 26. And we read these verses at the opening. Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. So he comes to the chief priests and says, "Well, you know, I could do something for you. I have an in. What are you going to give me for it?" So he has a bit of leverage here. And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And do you think, well, I don't think that he would have said, "Oh, okay, well, I guess that's enough," and may do with a small amount. I think he would have been arguing for a larger amount if he wasn't satisfied with it. But upon receiving the money, he goes out right away from that moment looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus. Now, this appears to be the action of a man who's satisfied or will be satisfied with the payment he's going to receive. And if he weren't satisfied, it would be a strange way to behave. Why would he go about doing their business if he wasn't satisfied with the payment? And one more thing. We read later in Matthew that a field was bought with this amount of money. And also in Acts, we read this as well. And I can't imagine that buying any piece of property would have been a pocket change affair. I think you would have had to have a little bit more money than that. He surely, 30 pieces of silver would have been worth a lot. Now, just to figure out, I've done some number calculation and a little bit of number crunching here, and from some values that I've got from a few different sources, and they all come out to quite a large amount. 30 pieces of silver is said by one source to be about 4 months' wages. And if you assume that skilled labor is worth $20 an hour, and you're working 8 hours a day, and you've got only 6 work days a week, and 4 weeks a month times 4 months, you've got more than $15,000. That's a lot of money. 30 pieces of silver. $15,000. Okay. Well, this isn't just pocket change, it seems, by that calculation. Another calculation, actually, let's just go to the event before Judas went to the leaders. And this was at the beginning of the reading we did this evening in chapter 26 of Matthew still, in verse 6, where Jesus goes to the house of Simon the leper, and there's this woman who comes in and anoints Jesus with this perfume, very expensive perfume, it says in Matthew. Well, I think that's an understatement. A bit of an understatement, because it was very, very expensive oil. In Mark 14, verse 5, we read that this ointment, "For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they scolded her, speaking of the disciples. Ointment that could have been sold for over 300 denarii. Well, a denarius was a day's wage for a laborer. And let's say that this laborer makes $15 an hour, and he works 10 hours a day. And I'm missing some numbers here, but I have the final calculation. I'll have to recheck this, but it's I come up with this calculation of $45,000. That's a lot. Even if it were half that, that's a lot of money to spend on perfume. Even if it were a third that, $10,000 even, to just be poured out, to anoint someone with that. It's no wonder that the disciples turned around and said, well, you should have sold this. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor. Or we should have done something worthwhile with this money. And yet, Jesus was not concerned about the cost of the oil. And he rebukes them who are indignant. And even says that this act was a better use of the ointment. This isn't exactly money management as we might imagine it. We might think the same question as disciples asked, well, why wasn't it sold? I would definitely have been one of those who was shocked at the use of this oil, wishing it had been put to more strategic purposes, perhaps. And maybe this is in itself is a lesson for us, that maybe we get far too focused on the material items and values for our own good. And Jesus' rebuke reminds us to keep our priorities straight. Was this Judas's motivation? Because the next verse, Judas goes to the chief priests. The very next thing that happens, in Mark 14:10, we read, Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him. Right after this event, maybe he figures, well, if one woman is willing to commit so much to Jesus, surely the guys who want him out of the way, who want him dead, would pay good money to see it happen. So, going back to the money that Judas was actually paid, again, another valuation of the amount. Excuse me, from the NIV Study Bible, we read, or they suggest that it's equivalent to 120 denarii. And laborers customarily received one denarius for a day's work. And according to this calculation, that's 120 days of work times 20 hours a day times 8 hours a day, which is $19,000 over that. And even if it's a little less, that's a significant amount as well. In fact, it's larger than the other amount we calculated. Another calculation puts this 30 pieces of silver in the range of $12,000 to $15,000. Any way we look at it, there is strong evidence, both biblical and historical, in considering the value of the money that's being dealt with here, it's being handled, to show that Judas would have earned no small sum. So it appears that this is the main motivation behind Judas's doing what he did. It appears that greed was high on his list. It appears that material wealth meant a lot to Judas. And it doesn't reflect very well on his character, does it? He completely missed the message of Jesus. He completely missed all of his message. And even when it came to feeling remorse for what he'd done, he still saw no hope at all. And he considered himself beyond redemption. and quite unlike Peter's situation. Now, they're very different, and we aren't involved in looking at sums of money with Peter, but it didn't even enter Peter's mind, I would suggest. I think if you offered $1 million to Peter, he wouldn't have betrayed his Lord in this way. Yet, he denied him. These two situations are often contrasted, and I think with very good reason, because it's this essential quality of the hope that we share that Jesus offers us forgiveness, that we have forgiveness because of what he did. And Judas felt that he was beyond it. Peter, on the other hand, learned from it. Now, we might ask, well, was Jesus really ready to forgive his betrayer? And of course, I think we'll probably all answer yes. David writes in Psalm 41, "Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me." And I think the elements of this psalm fit very well into the story, into the situation with Judas. We have this friend, familiar friend in whom I trusted. Well, in Matthew 26, again in verse 50, Jesus replies to Judas, "Friend, do what you came for. Friend, why have you come?" Again, in verse 23, we read of the account where Judas shared the meal with Jesus. And Jesus replied in verse 23, "The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me, and the Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to the man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." And then the last part of this heel, "have lifted up his heel against me," echoes right back to Genesis 3:15, where we see in Judas a rather, perhaps a personification of the serpent. But the main point I'd like to bring out of this is this idea of a friend. And Jesus isn't being sarcastic when he calls Judas a friend. Because he said in John 15:13, "Greater love hath no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends." And with this in mind, it's amazing that Jesus calls Judas friend. Because he seems to be saying to Judas, "Look, I'm about to lay down my life. You've got me into this, but I'm about to lay down my life, and it can be for you. Because yes, you still have a chance to be forgiven. And even in the last hour, as he's betraying him, he says, friend, to Judas, his betrayer. Well, how did Judas view friendship? I think he viewed it more in the light of Proverbs 19 verse 4 that says, "Wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend," or his so-called friend. And this, it seems, is what Judas was, a so-called friend. He was a friend who was no friend at all. He was there for gain. He had the mask of friendship, but his own motivations, his own goals. Proverbs 27 verse 6 also says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy." And this is exactly how Judas came to Jesus, seeking to appear as a friend with his greeting. So, how does this all add up, and how do we draw something from it for us? in our own lives, what is our perspective? We see what Judas's perspective might have been, one of deceit and really living a farce. How are we living? And the betrayal of Jesus is a very treacherous thing, and I'm not trying to say that we are all equal to Judas. But when I examine the show that Judas must have put on in his life to appear as a friend and appear as a disciple and appear a grateful follower, just for the chance to serve his own objectives, I can't help but examine my own motivations in my life. And I can't help but, maybe if we were to come up with a number to evaluate the ratio of time we spend serving our own ends versus that we spend serving our Lord, or that we even spend thinking about the things of God, what would that be? And that's just something to think about. Because we can all evaluate where we are in our lives. And we know we can always do better, can't we? But more than that, there's this stark reality of Judas's situation, and we've considered the sums of money involved, the temptations involved. And this was real. This happened. And I think it should strike a chord with each of us that our own positions before God are never something that we can take lightly or for granted. Because we have not earned anything. We cannot pay for eternal life with a sum of money, and we have no automatic inheritance. But seeing the mask that Judas put on, I just want us to seriously evaluate our sincerity, our dedication, and our love towards our God, just to make sure that we're on the right track, to keep ourselves in check, ensuring that it's not a show, and it's not a show for each one of us. That we're not friends and brothers and sisters in appearance only, but true friends of God and true friends of his Son. And we know of Abraham, it was said that he was a friend of God. He was called a friend of God. And so as Abraham, we can be heirs to the promise because of this. Complacency towards the things of God becomes humanism in our own lives. It becomes something that's self-serving. It becomes easy to do. And if it's practiced, it can become this betrayal. Betrayal of our hope, betrayal of this precious thing that we share, this precious thing we have. And betrayal without repentance is eternal death. And I would just like to go back to this verse in 2 Corinthians 12 to end, because I really liked how we began in there. Or 13, rather. 2 Corinthians 13. Judas did not have Christ living in him. He was living a mask. There was nothing in him that was worth keeping. We want something in us that will preserve us to the end. We want Christ in us. And this is what the first part of chapter 13 here is talking about. Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. And this is what the idea that I want us to leave with tonight is: test ourselves, be honest with ourselves, be honest with each other. Do you not realize that Christ Jesus is in you, unless, of course, you fail the test? And verse 6 goes on to say, and I trust that you will discover that we have not failed the test.